Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
The history of every Canadian city isn't always what we think it is. Some of it is recorded in the plaques we stumble upon in our walks, in local parks and waterfronts. Some of it is even written in our textbooks, but a lot of it, too much of it, is just not known. Take Oakville, Ontario. The city is almost 40 kilometers southwest from Toronto and known to be a largely white, affluent place. What many don't know is that it was 400 black people who escaped slavery through the Underground Railroad that shaped the Oakville we know today. They were farmers, barbers, weapon innovators, newspaper founders, and churchgoers. It's still Black History Month, so let's look a little deeper at Canada's cities and who really helped create and shape them. Fatma Sayed sitting in for Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Janelle Levy is a Toronto-based journalist who covers art, culture, and social justice. Hi, Janelle. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote this amazing story about Oakville's unknown Black history. Really, the origin story of Oakville. It was founded by Black people. Can you tell me how you stumbled upon this and what you've learned?
Well, I actually stumbled upon it because Oakville has been more proactive in erecting historical plaques around the city that commemorate this community. So actually, it was one of my family members who was walking in Burnett Park and saw a plaque that identified the historical Duncan home that initially made me interested in all of this. And while Black people definitely contributed to the economic security of Oakville and shaped this town, it was founded by slave owner Sir William Chisholm.
So it was a plaque that started it all. Walk us through the history of Oakville. It goes back to the, you know, mid-1800s. Tell us more about it.
Yes, the one significant thing about Oakville is that it's a port town, so the waterfront has always been really important. This was a big site of trade and ships coming and going, and it was later essential to the Underground Railroad. So a lot of formerly enslaved people in Oakville, they came through the waterway. So, of course, the Underground Railroad wasn't a very formal system. It was very much a grassroots activism system, and a lot of people came various different ways. So they would have escaped on foot for part of the journey. They would have walked through swamps through part of the journey. Some people who are coming from Pennsylvania would have had to cross a major river there. And then a lot of slaves, former slaves, were driven into Canada by truck, and then some were brought in by boat as well. And that's where 16 Mile Creek, which is still running in Oakville today, is very significant because a lot of people actually came to freedom on that particular river, which flows back into larger bodies of water near Detroit.
Can you tell us a little bit about James Wesley Hill? Because this is a fantastic person who I've never heard of until your story, who really created the community of Black people in Oakville.
Yes, James Wesley Hill is very significant. He escaped freedom back around 1850 from Maryland, and he crossed the Potomac River, which I can't emphasize how dangerous this would have been. To this day, there are still warnings of people to not go in the Potomac River. It has some of the fastest rapids in the world, and there's been a lot of drowning accidents. So to cross that as a formerly enslaved person who probably couldn't swim very well was utterly brave. Then he was concealed in a packing box and driven over the border into Canada. And he was very successful once he arrived here. At first, he worked for another farmer clearing land, and then he eventually acquired the farm that he was working on, which was about 100 acres. And the farmhouse that he built and the property still exists today. It's now privately owned. And his 100-acre enterprise helped lift the town out of a temporary economic depression around the 1930s. And he became the biggest producer of strawberries in Canada. But I think what's most impressive about his story is that he went back through the Underground Railroad countless times and rescued about 800 people over the course of his life.
So he helped free fellow people and bring them to Oakville, which is honestly the really brave and really amazing to think about.
Yes, he did. And so there's stories in the historical report that kind of commemorates his home at the City Hall level that he carried some of these people on his back and he hid them in cornfields. And then when they finally did arrive to safety in Oakville, he often employed them on his own farm.
It honestly gives me goosebumps to think about it. It struck me in your piece that, you know, the community that formed after he came over, you described them as entrepreneurs. We're talking about barbers, hairdressers, clothes cleaners, a gunsmith who, you know, modernized weaponry, and even someone who created a newspaper, which, you know, as a journalist, I loved. How did Oakville change with this influx of Black community?
Well, part of the entrepreneurship was out of necessity. We're talking people who were formerly enslaved. They had no access to education. A lot of them wouldn't have been able to read. And so they may not have been able to get traditional jobs. So they starting their own business was probably their best bet at being able to sustain themselves. And they didn't have to worry about being employed by other people. Oakville had a big merchant business in the sense small businesses, still somewhat of what you see today that exists on the lakeshore in the downtown Oakville neighborhood. That's a lot of what Oakville looked like back then. That part of the neighborhood was still very settled and home to many merchants.
And what I loved is that they all came together at the local church. And that's where the community stemmed from, which I find so interesting because there's so many churches, you know, in the cities that we live in that we walk past and we don't often think about the history those buildings have seen and sort of the kinds of people that cross through them and sort of their contributions to the spaces around the building. Tell us the significance of Turner Chapel, both to you and to this history and the role it played in shaping Oakville.
Yes, the church is really meaningful to me because I have passed it so many times growing up in Oakville as a teenager. I rode my bike past it. I drove past it countless times to school, but I never realized the significance of it now. It's still there, it still stands, but it now hosts an antique store, and it's about 15 minutes from where I grew up. Turner Chapel was the heartbeat of this Black community. So oftentimes they're arriving in a new country, they don't know anybody. So the first place to turn to in community was the church. And we have to understand, even in white churches back then, the church played a very different role in society. A lot of your social life would have revolved around church. The church held picnics, socials, functions, held volunteer opportunities. All of the holidays, Christmas, Thanksgiving would have revolved around church as well. A lot of people found people to marry within the church. So it really became almost like the nexus of this community.
You know, you talk about being the only Black family on the street where you lived in Oakville and how, you know, struck you were by the history that you found, that you stumbled upon, really, from reading this one plaque. What was the most surprising thing you learned about, you know, the city you grew up in?
I think overall, just that Black people had existed there for so long. Now, Oakville has changed quite a bit. I would say that about 30 to 40% of the city now identifies as visible minorities. But back when I was growing up there in 2007, it was still majority white. We also have this narrative in Canada that most racial minorities are immigrants. And that's true for many people, but not for everyone. There are a lot of people who have been here for hundreds of years, including Black people, Indigenous people, obviously, are some of the first people to live in Canada, and even Chinese people have had a very long history in Canada, dating back to the 1800s. So I think that's really what surprised me the most, because some of the things that I've encountered growing up in the suburbs is the idea that perhaps me and my family don't belong in this neighborhood, especially if it's a more affluent neighborhood. There's always anxieties that in the past and in certain communities have triggered white flight. That hasn't happened in our community. But people definitely take notice when a Black family moves into the neighborhood, almost with this sense of hesitation. And so it really personally empowered me to know that people who looked like me had existed in this very town, almost minutes from where I grew up, for hundreds of years.
Yeah, and it really challenges the misconception that we have often about Canadian cities, that they are predominantly founded or were settled by white people. Are there other sort of pockets of Black history in Canadian cities that would surprise our listeners?
Yes, there are many. And I will just quickly say that Oakville was founded by a white man, the actual town as we know it, Sir William Chisholm, who did own slaves, at least one to two slaves in his Urchelas estate. But in many other communities, and as well as Oakville, Black people were there and they contributed to the town and the narrative of the town. One of the biggest settlements outside of Toronto would be St. Catharines, which might surprise a lot of people. So back in 1855, there were overall approximately 7,000 people living in St. Catharines, and 500 of those people were newly freed Black people. Many of them had found freedom through the Underground Railroad, and a lot more arrived in the 1950s. They have beautiful historical homes, some of which have still been preserved today. And my favorite fact about St. Catharines that a lot of people don't know is its connection to Harriet Tubman. So a lot of people in Canada and in the U.S. are very aware of Harriet Tubman and how many people she brought to freedom through the Underground Railroad. Well, the significant town where she arrived, usually at the end of that journey, was St. Catharines. And she rescued a lot of Black Americans and brought them to St. Catharines. Her own family lived in St. Catharines. So there's a really big connection in St. Catharines to that. Frederick Douglass also took up a residence in St. Catharines for a period of time. So the history in a town like that is very, very rich. Another town that stands out is London, Ontario. So back in 1848, around 500 Black people lived there as well. The dynamics, I think, of that town would have been a little bit different based on this little known fact, which is that a lot of Black people lived on a street called Thames Street. But back in 1855, it was often referred to as Nigger Hollow in a very derogatory way. But another interesting thing about London is that in 1853, one of the largest conventions for free Black people was held there. So again, a lot of these towns have a complicated history. I highlighted Oakville in my story because I had personal ties to it, but it's actually, there are many communities like Oakville across southern Ontario, in Bransford, in Dresden, in a lot of the communities that surround Toronto within about 2 to 3 hours.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were gonna prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
How difficult was it for you to find this history? Because it's not, and I hate to say this, it's not readily available, right? We spoke about this in a previous episode. Black history still isn't taught in Canada, although it's, you know, gaining some momentum. And like, I'm an immigrant. I didn't read any of this in the immigrant handbook, which has a whole history section about, you know, Canada's founding and so forth. For you in your research, how easily are you able to find this history of these various Canadian cities?
Well, I think it speaks to a larger problem of how Black history and Black people's contributions in Canada are often erased from our history. And I think part of that has to do that with the fact that if Canada wanted to be honest about Black history in this country, we'd also have to be honest about the slave trade that existed here and the racial segregation that existed here. It was a little bit difficult for me to find this information. I will say that when it came to Oakville has done a much better job of preserving this history. One huge advantage that Oakville had was Alvin Duncan, who was an informal historian and an incredible figure. He was the patriarch who owned the house that I talked about in the story, who was the father of Arlene Duncan, who I interviewed. So that home that had been passed down through the generations was the Duncan home. And Alvin Duncan was very passionate, and he had preserved a lot of his family history. And before his death, he had donated a lot of pictures, a lot of archives to the Oakville Museum and the Oakville Historical Society. And the curators there, many of who assisted me with this story, were very passionate, and they did a wonderful job of archiving that history. And I would say when it came to Oakville, this particular history is really accessible. The Oakville Museum has had an amazing exhibit on Black history for about 6 years. Oakville is also really passionate, even more than some other communities, about preserving its history. So City Hall has a program and specifically has a team designated to preserving heritage homes. And when somebody does decide to make one of these older homes a heritage home, they do a lot of research about the background and the story of that home. So that was one of the ways that I got a lot of information from James Hill that came from the heritage report that outlines the historical references to his home.
So it sounds like there needs to be a greater movement among municipalities and academia to really start opening our minds to the Black history that exists in Canadian cities.
Yes, I definitely think that's true. A wonderful article I was just reading in Toronto Star by Danica Samuel was talking about how our own mayor, where I live in Toronto, John Tory, has over the years made many proclamations, which is basically days of awareness to commemorate Black Canadians. The latest one being the musician The Weeknd, who had a very prominent performance at the Super Bowl. But even with that initiative, Mayor Tory really hasn't thought about all of the Black civil rights activists and all of the historical figures that we could be giving proclamation days to, who probably need even more than a proclamation day, an official holiday, something akin to what Americans have with Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Even take the example of Viola Desmond, who is now on our Canadian $10 bill. Most Canadians didn't know of her existence before that happened. Neither did I, for that matter. So I think we need to have a much bigger conversation about the way we teach Black history in schools. And I think what's most interesting is that the province of Ontario has made some moves towards being more inclusive of Black history in the curriculum. But for some reason, teachers are still not necessarily teaching that history in the classroom. And so I think it's a multi-tiered problem. We need to do a better job of honoring these people at the municipal and provincial levels. We also need to make sure that we're providing better training and support to teachers to make sure that they feel comfortable teaching this history, because this is history that they would not have learned themselves as children in school. And we also need to have more academics studying this at the university level. So I think universities have to have an honest conversation about their history faculties and look at who they're bringing into these programs and who can be contributing to this research at the academic level.
Well, as you said previously, it's not just about honoring the people, but also their contributions, right? Like if I'm walking by a farmhouse or a church or even just a random plaque, as we've learned from your experience, along the lake or something, there's a history to that. And we need to make it more accessible and more available for people to learn and understand. I know we've spoken a lot about Ontario cities. Are there cities in other parts of Canada that also have rich Black histories that you can point us towards?
Yes. Nova Scotia overall as a province has probably some of the richest Black history in Canada, or I should just say they have done the best job of documenting their Black history. They have local museums there that have done a great job of highlighting this. Most academics who are studying this exist at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia. They have several faculty who examine and commemorate that history. They also have strong ties to the American Revolution. So something that a lot of people don't know is that during the American Revolution, which was the war where America overthrew the British and essentially became America, the British had a proposal for enslaved Black people, which was that if they fought on the British side against America, they could gain freedom in Canada. So a lot of Black people did fight for the British in that battle. And once the war was over, the British obviously lost, but they maintained their promise and brought these, what are now referred to as Black loyalists, to Nova Scotia. And they were given pieces of land that were theirs, and they could farm that land and create an existence for themselves. So that is partially why Nova Scotia has such a strong Black history there. They also have a community that I believe still exists that historically was referred to as Afriqueville. And this is a history that Lawrence Hill has written about in his book, The Book of Negroes.
What advice would you give to, you know, people living in any Canadian city who are trying to learn more about the history around them? How should they go about it?
I would say that our public libraries can be such a resource. All of the books that I mentioned are available at public libraries. I often find in my own career that librarians are very knowledgeable. And if you go up to the information desk and ask for specific information about this, often they are very well educated about books that they could lend to you. I also would encourage people to check out their local museums. I think, especially in the GTA, there's a desire to always look to Toronto in terms of cultural institutions. There are very good local institutions, just like in Oakville, who have done an incredible job preserving their history. The admissions are usually very low, somewhere in the range of like $10 to $15. I would also encourage school teachers, who I think have a special opportunity, to really think innovatively about their field trips and the field trips that they can be taking students on. It's not that hard to take students who are in Burlington or the Halton region into a field trip in St. Catharines, or even if you're a teacher in Hamilton, look around at the opportunities that exist for you. And overall, I think that our city and province needs to do a better job of partnering with cultural institutions, partnering with educators to create exhibits for educational opportunities. A lot of Canadians would tell you that they would feel very comfortable recounting World War II history. Well, part of that is because there's been a lot of exhibits about that part of history that are very accessible. It's been commemorated in pop culture extensively, which I think is another opportunity where hopefully young Canadian storytellers can be putting these stories into the pages of books and on the screen, because that really does give an advantage in terms of the history that people know and that they don't.
Well, hopefully someone will make a movie about Oakville's Black history, right? And until then, we'll just keep reading and being mindful of the history around us and challenging our misconceptions wherever we go. Thanks so much for bringing this to us, Janelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Janelle Levy, a Toronto-based journalist who covers art, culture, and social justice. And that was The Big Story. You can find more at thebigstorypodcast.ca. If you want to send us a message, you can find us on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn. You can also send us an email, The Big Story Podcast at rci.rogers.com. I'm Fatna Sayed. Thanks for listening.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.